by ministry opportunities or volunteering in their kids' classrooms. Students who loved learning in traditional education but also longed to take off and explore the world. The office worker who dreams of opening an art studio or building a home and a family. As it turns out, we all have our things. We all have the stuff that fills our hearts and the stuff that fills our days. We just need to figure out how to make it all work together, like my grandpa did. His love for building, creating, and helping didn't take him out of his life. It grounded him more deeply in it. And I think that's what we are all seeking to find in this wild goose chase after all. A way to fill our days with the stuff that fills our hearts. There's a deeply rooted yearning in all of us, I think, to be part of something bigger than us. Something that matters. Something that will go on long after we are gone and make a difference. But somehow, in an instant, as the pastor spoke and the stories were told, and wrinkled cheeks brushed each other in long hugs, it all began to make a little more sense. What if this bigger thing I've been searching for has been right here all along? What if this thing that matters and will live on long after I'm gone is right in front of me, staring back at me through the eyes of those who share my days and my bathroom and my table? What if this huge, magnificent impact I dream of making isn't something I accomplish or build or do? What if it's who I show up for, who I serve, who I love? We all have these convictions, don't we? These things we wish the world would become. The things we want to stand for, tattoo on our arm, and pray our neighborhoods will turn into. But what if we are a bigger part of making these changes than we realize? What if God meant what he said when he told us to love our neighbor as ourselves? Is that really something we are doing? What I am doing? Or have I been so busy building bigger, dreaming larger, and encouraging the already encouraged that I've missed the whole point? I can still picture walking to school past the Parsonage building as a teenager, waving to my grandpa as he pushed the mower. His hands dirty with the smearing of soil, his smile creased from age but brighter than ever. I must have done this 100 times throughout my high school years, and I never gave it a second thought. But that day in October, pictures of him with his mower and his jigsaw and his shovel filled my every thought. 91 bells began to ring from the old church steeple, the same steeple he and Grandma were married under 67 years ago and my mom was baptized in. Tears began to rise up, and I struggled to hold them back. The room was silent, uncomfortable. Everyone staring blankly in different directions as we were all forced to listen and be still. Ding. 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 1 year. 2 years. 3. No one said a word, but they didn't have to. I knew what they were all thinking. Every one of them had been touched by the sincere heart and servant's hands of my favorite grandpa. He never did anything fancy or huge or earth-shattering. What he did was better than all of that. Because he loved as Jesus did, with availability and presence and showing up for people using the gifts he had to offer. I began to realize that he didn't have to change the whole world because he had changed my whole world. And on that crisp, sunny fall day, I sat among a few hundred people who felt the same way. Each one changed forever by the love of a man carrying a saw, a shovel, and a smile. His life was proof that the lies we tell ourselves don't actually carry the weight we give them. The ones that say, there is nothing special about you. You don't have anything to offer. The lies that ask us, who would really want what you have to give? He squashed all of those lies when he chose to use the seemingly insignificant things he did well as an offering to those around him. He broke the mold and brought truth to those whispers with the testimony of a life well lived, a family well loved, and a community well served. I can't help but wonder what people will say of me one day, and I think it's wise to give it some time to mull over. We never know how life will play out or when our time will run out. If we want to leave a legacy, we must live the life we want to be remembered for now. We must do it today, and then again tomorrow. For legacies aren't built around one big change or grand gesture. They are built brick by brick, over time, with one little act, one little word, one little smile. It's been months now since his service, and I wonder what I have in my toolbox that I can use to love like he did. What passions do I carry that I can bring home or next door or to the kids' school? And maybe you should start wondering, too. How can we overflow our unique talents and bring them into our everyday, to our kids, to our homes, to our communities? What gifts do we all carry that we may have thought were limited to our jobs, our ministries, or committees that could change our whole worlds if we simply redirected and duplicated them? When I left church that day, I felt a fire ignited in my soul to start remembering who I was before all of the jobs and titles and accolades. To start cultivating who I was created to be for Ava and Isaiah and Logan and my amazing hunk of a husband, Isaac. Who was I created to be for them? More than just filling their bellies and folding their clothes, what is my part of their story? What am I supposed to say? What gifts am I supposed to encourage? What conversations am I supposed to have? What am I supposed to show them through my actions towards them and the words I speak? What dreams of theirs am I supposed to support? What tools do I have in my toolbox that are meant to help them build their path? What tools do you have in yours? The questions swirled like wildfire, picking up more strength as I gave them more fuel, and soon it all became convictingly clear. More than those I serve in my work, I want to be a stepping stone in the lives God has put right in front of me. I want to fill my todays with experiences and adventures that will make tomorrow's memories a happy story, not a heartbreaking one. I want to live a life worthy of a standing room only service and a wake of stories. Because it really is true. The passing of a life can hit us like a raindrop of information or an ocean of emotion. And I want to leave an ocean. Chapter 20. Return to Me. Don't let other people decide who you are. Bob Goff. I stepped onto the mat and started drying off from my toes up. The bath is my happiest of places. The warmth, the silence. It's like soaking in a hug from my Savior and giving my body and mind space to finally pause and take a breath. There are no tasks in the bathtub. Just soaking and silence and pondering and planning. We don't have a tub at our home right now, so whenever I travel for work, I always book the room with the nicest bathroom, and I hope, a huge bathtub. This time I was in a lodge just outside of Nashville with a small leadership team. As I dried off, I heard something that jolted me, but not in an abrasive way, more like an unexpected invitation way. I paused as the lyrics of one of my favorite singers filled the air and instantly took me back 15 years. Something foreign and distant, yet familiar and true. As I followed the sound into the other room, the words and melodies echoed through the air, and it felt as if I was stepping into my own skin again, like I had finally made my way home. I stood for several minutes just listening and drinking it in. Why is this so weird? I wondered. This used to be my everyday rhythm. This used to be me. And now that I thought of it, it used to be Isaac and me too, together. So why did this feel so different? Why was something that used to be as comfortable as my favorite worn in blue hoodie suddenly feeling so foreign, so strange? As I continued to get closer to the music, the strong, smooth tone of Tim McGraw's voice embraced me like the welcomed hug of a loved one seen after years apart. Suddenly I realized why this whole situation was so haunting. I don't listen to country music anymore, I thought. Actually, I haven't listened to country music in years. The realization was almost paralyzing as I sought to ponder the situation. How on earth did this happen? Why? When? How had the music that was the anthem of my childhood and the soundtrack of Isaac and me falling in love under the Texas sky become completely non-existent in my life? Where did it go? Why had it gone away? I sat on the bed in complete disbelief and a bit of sorrow. I couldn't understand how something that I loved so much had simply disappeared. It dawned on me that somewhere along the way, the opinions of people around me and the voices of those who lived within my walls had somehow stripped me of my own. In 16 years of marriage and 12 of motherhood, the giving, wiping, cooking, making, cleaning, hugging, teaching, and reading to the rhythm of everyone else's needs had somehow silenced my own. Don't worry, friend, I'm not going to start rambling about self-care. That's a tangent for another day. But I do think it's important to consider another topic that may have been forsaken, being self-aware. I think it's safe to say that my revelation of a love long forgotten isn't an isolated case. As mamas and wives and daughters and sisters and friends and creatives, it's so easy to spend our entire lives answering the needs of everyone around us, only to find ourselves years later, alone in a room, wrapped in a towel with tears streaming down our face as we remember pieces of ourselves that somehow disappeared along the way. Trust me, I know this seems super trivial, but God can use seemingly insignificant things to wake us up to what is eternally significant. If I had let something so dear to my heart fade away over time, what else had God woven into my being that I'd let the busyness of life or the needs of others hush silent? It seems to me that allowing the loves of our heart to be washed away by the busy can somehow turn down the volume of God's voice in our life, or at least the volume in which we are able to hear it. But when we are filling our days with the things that light our hearts on fire and feel authentic to our own souls, it creates an atmosphere where we can hear God more easily. Have you ever found this to be true? Are there places you go, or things you do, or music you listen to that wakes up your insides and makes you feel more connected to God? Is it easier to hear God in those spaces? It sure seems to ring true in our family. Our oldest daughter, Ava, feels more connected when she is painting or baking or playing the piano, while our middle son feels more alive and close to God when he's adventuring outside, running wild and unhindered. For my husband, the closeness happens in the mountains or when he gets to serve others. For me, it's a warm bath, a quiet beach, a walk around our property, or the sounds of 90s country music filling my home while I cook dinner. When I'm in these spaces with these sounds, I'm flourishing in the best parts of who I am. My stresses are silenced, my worries fall to the wayside, and my heart feels open to receive what God has for me. We all have these things, I think, locations, lyrics, and loves that make us who we are and help us find the path we are supposed to walk down. In His grace, God has given us different gifts for doing certain things well. So if God has given you the ability to prophesy, speak out with as much faith as God has given you. If your gift is serving others, serve them well. If you are a teacher, teach well. If your gift is to encourage others, be encouraging. If it is giving, give generously. If God has given you leadership ability, take the responsibility seriously. And if you have a gift for showing kindness to others, do it gladly. Romans 12:6 through 8. It's these unique gifts and passions that pave the way for our purpose. Some way, somehow, I believe all of these bends of ours are integral pieces of our bigger story, woven together in ways only God can do. And if we neglect the little pieces that make us come alive, I think that over time, the bigger passions and the things we know we were made to do will start to fade too. Since my post-bubble bath epiphany in Nashville, I have made it a point to start listening to more of my favorite old country music. It may seem insignificant or even dumb, and I get that. But there's something magical about reconnecting with bits of yourself long silenced that can rekindle your insides and prepare you for what's next. And my hubby, in the sweetest of ways, has joined the party too. It's not a rarity for him to come up behind me in the kitchen, grab my hand, and pull me into a full dance right there by whatever is simmering on the stove. We sway and kiss and get all caught up in each other again until a kid wraps us in their hug and starts to dance too. But the sweetness hasn't ended there. Strangely, and very unexpectedly, this new rhythm of mine, in the oddest of ways, has changed almost everything. My creativity has been ignited, and my path has become clearer. With less stress and more joy in my surroundings, I've been able to see what I need to be doing more of and what I should take off my plate and do less of. I've thought of new ideas and become more intentional with old ones. My yeses and nos are said with more purpose, more certainty. And somehow, almost unexplainably so, there is more laughter within our walls, too. Maybe because it feels as though I've returned to myself again, and there's so much freedom in that, so much rightness. It seems silly that playing different music during the day has led to such monumental change in our home, but friend, I can't make this stuff up. I know there isn't magic in Tim McGraw's songs. Well, to me there is, but that's beside the point. What I have found more powerful is that there is a certain magic in returning to the pieces of us we once loved and somehow lost along the way. There's magic in planting tulips, taking a dance class, sitting down to play the piano again, hitting a yard sale, or picking up that camera you boxed up years ago. There's magic in watering the seeds in our souls that were sown there by our Father, who knows what's best for us and made us that way with great intention. What dusty, forgotten things of yourself could hold life-altering magic for you? What would happen if you took time for them again? How would you feel? What possibilities could unfold if you took the steps to uncover your truest self? What legacy could you change? I fully believe that the invitation to our destiny is ingrained in our desires. There's magic in waking up, rediscovering our way, and getting lost in the things that used to keep us up at night. There's magic there, because that's where we can hear God the clearest. At least I found that in my own life. When we shed the busyness of unending tasks to study the beauty of our unique souls, we'll find pieces of our purpose awaken, and glimpses of the Father we may have never noticed before. When the striving is silenced and we confidently settle into who we are truly created to be, we can finally hear the voice that's been trying to get our attention all this time. And I think we should start listening. Chapter 21, Culture of Home. What begins in the home stretches into eternity. Sally Clarkson. I walked in and spotted the orange round treehouse fort at the back of the store. It has been calling me year after year for more than a decade. I've always wanted to bring it home, and yet I never can. Last summer, as we paid off our last bills and closed the sale on our house to buy some property in the country, I remember grinning ear to ear thinking, next summer will be my summer. Next summer will finally be the year I get to bring the treehouse home. We had done so well with downsizing over the past few years. We made really hard choices and lived in a teeny fixer-upper while we paid down bills. I'd wanted to get this treehouse since the first summer Ava could walk, and I couldn't believe that after 10 years of waiting, it would finally be mine. Even though we had missed the young years of our oldest kids, God had brought us a new babe, and hopefully he would grow to love it as I always dreamed my other children would. As I walked toward the back of the store, being sure to go down every aisle of the gardening and outdoor play section, I got up close. This year there was something new, a twisty tube slide. It's my favorite kind of slide, as I don't have to worry about children jumping from the top of it or pushing each other out. And this year, it was only $999. I couldn't believe it. That was the cheapest one I had ever seen. Usually they were well over $1,000 and sometimes even $1,500. I was filled with the glimmer of hope that maybe this year could be it. Maybe this year we could finally bring it home to our kids. As I took a photo and turned to walk away, my eyes filled with tears. I choked them back in disbelief that I was getting misty about a play structure and just kept walking. I made my way outside and pushed my cart to the car. It was my daughter's birthday. She was turning 11. I opened the back of the car and turned to the cart where I gathered up two rotisserie chickens and a carton of croissants I had bought. It totaled $19.99. Probably the cheapest meal you could possibly find to feed 11 people, and nothing like the birthday dinner I had imagined and planned for her just weeks before. This was supposed to be our summer, remember? Our year of financial freedom. We had just spent two solid, hard years in 1,000 square feet with five people, paying off debt, being responsible, and saying no to every extra expense. Yet, because I had misread a contract from the conferences we run, here I was again. Under the weight of so much business debt, I could barely breathe. Because of my mistakes, we could barely afford two whole chickens for my daughter's birthday party, and I was having to say no to my beloved treehouse again, for the 10th year in a row. Tears started to well up again, and I began to ask myself, why on earth is that treehouse so important to me? Why do I have this decade-long obsession with this wooden Costco wonderland? And then, as quickly as the question came, so did the answer. I immediately heard the voice of my father on my heart. It's the only place you ever felt safe. It's the only place you ever felt home. Instantly, I flashed back to my own 11-year-old self, watching the sunset over the mountains from the top of our cedar trees behind my house. I would go up there all the time back then, to a land my brothers and I constructed of tree forts and catwalks and rope ladders that would make even Ewoks jealous. I'd go there to escape, to think, to process and dream, but mainly to get away from the tension that lived inside the walls of our home. In an instant, with one thought from his heart, it all made sense. I wasn't trying to buy my kids a treehouse. I was trying to buy myself one. My 34-year-old self, decades after my childhood, was longing for a tiny space high above the ground where I could be alone with my father, and maybe my kids would learn to meet him there too. This sense of home and safety and roots had almost become a god to me over the years. Something I clung to because clinging to people was too fragile, too risky. And clinging to God? Well, I wasn't too sure about him most days either during that season. As I reflected back on my time in the trees, my heart immediately returned to Adam, a boy I'd known from birth who was more brother than neighbor. He was the right arm of my actual older brother, Luke. He caught the first piece of my childhood heart with his twinkling blue eyes, blonde hair that fell across his forehead, and contagious smile. As a new fifth grader in the vast sea of towering eighth graders, Adam's nod and beaming smile as we passed in the hall always made me feel safe again, just as he had my whole life. He and Luke had a way about them that just said, "Everything will be okay. I've got your back, and I'm not going anywhere." It's the way every girl needs to feel growing up, but it's the lucky ones of us who actually do. I remember walking between my brother and Adam in the halls of my school and feeling like the queen of the world. With them, I was untouchable, invincible, and safe, always safe. It had been like this my whole life, until one afternoon in September when my whole world shattered to pieces. That afternoon, a typical after-school football practice became a turning point of my childhood, a scar on my family, and a prickly point between God and me that he's still teaching me how to make smooth again. Adam collapsed on the football field that day in front of my brother Luke and the entire eighth grade team. His jersey, number 44, was cut off as people came to his aid and he was rushed off in an ambulance. Luke returned home early and told us the news. I remember my little brother Cody leaving the room and re-entering with his hand on the Bible. "Maybe this can help," he said in his sweet 8-year-old voice. "That is not going to help," I foolishly whipped back at him. My words cut with the tone of an unapproving tween girl, and I could almost visibly see his hope diminish. To this day, saying those words is one of the deepest regrets of my entire life. My heart sank further, and although I instantly wanted to take back what I had just snapped out, I was simultaneously paralyzed with the fear that maybe, possibly, I was actually right. That God wasn't going to come through in the way we wanted after all. Believing nothing I could say or do could take back what I had already done, I decided to say nothing more. We all just sat there, silent, dealing with our own doubts, fears, and disbeliefs in our own ways. It felt like eternity as we waited for an update. I can still picture the scene as if I actually had a photograph of it. I can feel the tension, the fear, all of us staring at the floor, Luke pacing in the hall, Cody sitting there silently holding his Bible and hanging his head. I can still hear the knock on the door and the sound of the teammates' voices passing on the news that Adam was gone. My whole family sank into a dark cloud of sadness, Luke first, then the rest of us. We collapsed into grief and then unbelief and then back again. That afternoon, my naive young heart stepped out of a childhood I could never return to and stepped into the reality that the world isn't always good and things don't always go the way we want. Simultaneously, it planted a seed in my 10-year-old soul that God was good to everyone else. He answered others' prayers. He came through for them. But me? My prayers? They simply weren't worth enough to catch his attention. I started spending a lot of time in the trees after that. In quiet, in deep questioning. The same trees that we had played in with Adam now held a different emotion. Unquenchable pain. Whenever things in my adolescent heart would become too much to bear, I found myself walking out back, climbing up 30 feet of branches, and sitting among the treetops watching the sunset over the hills. If I could venture a guess, I'd say that all of us are somehow trying to make our way back to our own version of the treetops. We all have them, the spaces that have held our tears and brought safety to our hearts and belonging to our souls. Maybe it's a certain coffee shop you always go to, or a closet, or a car. Maybe it's not a place at all and you find your solace in a brownie or a bottle, or possibly both. However it unfolds for you, there's this deep ache in all of us to know we are safe and heard and held. And if we don't feel like Jesus is that place for us, we will search it out however we can, trying to heal the hurts with anything that will bring relief, even if it's just for a minute. This same heart cry has paved the way for me to be so intentional with the culture of our home as an adult. If others don't feel that they can go to God directly, I want to provide a place of peace so they can rest here. And hopefully, prayerfully, He will meet them while they are here, just as He has with me. This mission of providing solace and safety has given me a plumb line to help define what we stand for within our walls and what we strive to keep out of them. I want to welcome questions and allow those who are here to wrestle with God on their own and know they are still loved and still safe. Above all, I want our home to stand for safety and belonging. I want all who enter to be bombarded with peace and understanding and prayer. And more than likely, a home-cooked meal that fills more than their bellies. All of this, ironically, was unfolding in my heart as I made my way through the aisles of my favorite grocery warehouse. As I walked outside and started wiping the tears from my face, the Lord began to fill me with an urgency to make invitation my anthem, just as He had with us. We all have our battles, and more than likely, we will all find ourselves wrestling with God at some point or another as broken dreams and unanswered prayers crash their way into our lives. And it's important that we all have a safe place to land and cry and fight through it when we do. He reminded me that Jesus loved with invitation, not obligation. He provides safety and acceptance and love for all of us to fall into and find the pieces we need to get back up again. And now He was inviting me to be an extension of His great love for people, to use my home as His healing room and my family as His face to a world searching for hope. He invited me to be an inviter and asked me to use my welcome mat as our new mission. And I can't wait to see who He'll bring through our door. Chapter 22. James. God is more interested in your character than your comfort, and He's more concerned about your holiness than your happiness. Rick Warren. I've always been a big dog person. Huge dogs, really. In the land of towering evergreen trees and steel cases full of hunting weapons, we were always taught that dogs had to serve a purpose or they weren't worth having. I grew up with a mess of dogs, all trained specifically for retrieving fallen birds in fields full of tall grass and marshlands. And although I didn't exactly inherit the hunting gene, I do carry with me a fascination for big, lovable puppies. So when it came time for us to add a pup to our family, I did what any normal, or obsessive, adult would do. I perused the internet for hours on end, discovering everything there was to know about these four-legged furry friends. After multiple dog-matching personality tests, I found myself face-to-face with the cutest, ugliest, largest animal baby I had ever seen. I was smitten. His big, droopy eyeballs and gentle giant personality had me at hello, and I knew instantly I was having my very own Jerry Maguire moment with my newest love, the English Mastiff. I've always been a jump-and-then-think type of person, so this sudden intrigue turned extreme obsession didn't catch me off guard. However, all of my ooing and awing over this elegant giant creature seemed to be lost on my family. I was certain they would love this majestic fur baby as much as I did, but oddly, his pictures didn't seem to capture their attention at all. You'd think this would have been a sign, and in hindsight, I wish it had been. But I can get insanely tunnel-visioned when I want something. I'm working on it, I promise. But if things make sense to me, it's hard for me to stop until I've persuaded everyone else around me that what I'm desiring to do is the absolute best decision we can make. In this extreme commitment I hold to my ideals, it may seem as if I'm nagging or controlling, but that's not the case. At least not exactly. It's more like this. I discover something. I get excited. I talk about it constantly and subscribe to multiple websites to ensure a constant stream of this topic invades my inbox. My people, over time, are worn down. Not by nagging, but by the simple fact that my behavior is pretty insane, and they really just want me to stop talking about whatever it is I'm obsessing over, so they cave. The old me would have been super pumped about this result. I would have felt some sort of twisted victory knowing that I had turned their perspectives and shown them the light. But time has changed that for me. Time and a sweet brown-eyed boy named James. More on that soon. After my family had been worn down by my neurotic puppy-loving behavior, they agreed that we should bring home an English Mastiff puppy as our next pet. I was delighted with their decision, and despite their annoyed tones and surrendering shrugs, I was certain this was a fantastic idea. I quickly narrowed down my choice of breeders by the dogs they had available in color, proximity, and price. I chatted weekly with the one I chose and bought custom engraved doggy goodies for our new sweet boy. Sweet puppy James, to be exact. You know, because of my favorite book in the Bible and my obsession with James Taylor. It was the perfect mix, and I was thrilled with myself. What I didn't know, or more accurately, what I didn't take time to notice, was that I was the only one in our family who was thrilled about this addition. As the calendar pages turned and my excitement heightened, I started to pick up on an increased number of eye rolls when I mentioned James's name. We are an animated family that veers heavily down the lanes of sarcasm, so the eye rolls alone didn't really catch me by surprise. However, soon those eye rolls carried accompanying comments such as, "Why do you want such a huge dog, Mom?" And, "I'm glad you're excited about your new puppy, but it certainly won't be ours." My heart twisted. I was pulled between something I really wanted and had dreamed of and what the people I loved most wanted, which, in reality, shouldn't have even been a close race. But if you haven't noticed yet, I was at a whole new level of crazy. And reality or common sense wasn't exactly something I picked up on easily. I wish I had listened when I first felt it. The hesitancy in their voices, the lack of peace, the frustration from my tribe. I wish I had put on the brakes before allowing my heart to get more involved, more set, more in love. And I think that's why I wanted to share this story with you, to hopefully spare you from the same stumbles and heartache that I've endured, no matter what want it is you're currently chasing. Because, you see, I didn't pay attention to the signs. Instead, I ignored the whispers and the rolls of the eyes. I continued my conversations with the breeder and let myself believe all would be well as soon as they met this sweet little pup. I mean, who can hate a puppy, right? We ended up welcoming James into our family a few weeks before Christmas. He was clumsy and adorable and finally mine. I felt as if I'd waited my whole life for him, but in reality, it had only been a few years. He was a bit more spirited than most Mastiffs, but his big brown eyes had found their instant place in my heart. His awkward paws were too big for his 8-week frame to handle, and it wasn't long before he tripped, blood showed up in his urine, and we ended up in the emergency vet on a Tuesday evening. Not 5 minutes in our home and we landed in puppy ER. Looking back, those moments feel a bit prophetic, and I probably should have taken the hint that this might have been a really bad idea. The months that followed seemed to be filled with story after story of unforeseen incompatibility. James hated the car, which led to more than one accident where he pooped all over the backseat, stepped in it, and then jumped over the seats onto our children and me. If you've never tried to drive while holding a 70-pound puppy covered in poop in your lap, I suggest you don't try it. You're definitely not missing out on a fun party. With every unwanted puppy milestone, like eating a child's toy, peeing all over the floor, and plowing over a wobbly 18-month-old, the Stop Tribe became even more frustrated, and I became even more torn. Previously annoyed eye rolls morphed into full-on yelling spurts by everyone in the house. The baby was knocked over time and time again, and with every puppy antic, the stares I got from my people got sharper. And by this, I mean, in full disclosure, they could cut glass. Who knew that all it would take to turn an easygoing house of laughter into a ticking time bomb of yelling, crying, and frustration was a pony-sized puppy? The tension in our home was tangible and ever-present, and honestly, everybody was just really, really on edge. Everyone hated James but me, and Logan, our sweet little toddler, was now petrified of him. As days went on, the words of my friend Bob started echoing through my mind. Everyone asks, how's that working for you? But the better question to ask is, how's it working for everyone else around you? His words caused me to stop in my tracks the first time I heard them a few years back, and I couldn't shake them as I pondered how to navigate this situation. A deep conviction began to fall on my heart about how my selfishness had blinded me from the desires and well-being of my own family. Over the next few weeks, every puppy-provoked problem sent a ping to my soul. Paul talked about love to the Philippians, and one thing that stuck out to me was this. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves. Chapter 2, verse 3. Ouch. Somebody please let me go back in time and redo this decision. Despite the poopy paws and potty training in the midst of a rainy Northwest winter, I had really grown to love this little horse puppy of mine. But the frustration that spilled out of the mouths and eyes of the loves I shared this life with were casting a huge shadow on my joy. I began to wonder if it was worth the trouble it was causing. I spent the next few weeks watching and praying. I didn't want to be hasty, but I also knew the way we were living wasn't working. We had had plenty of animals that worked out just fine after a while. Our first Mastiff, which we lost a few years ago, was basically our soul puppy. The whole family loved him, so I knew it wasn't a forever and always issue, or even an English Mastiff issue. It was a right now, with this specific dog issue. Once I finally stopped to pay attention, the answer became glaringly obvious. As adults, we are responsible for tending to the tone of our home and creating an environment that encourages love, joy, laughter, and peace. If those things aren't present, we need to pay attention and do some serious atmospheric inventory. Something had shifted drastically in our home that opened us up to a world of walking on eggshells, holding in anger, and no longer being able to connect with each other for fear of hurting someone's feelings with our honesty. It seems silly that something as small as a dog could make such a big impact. But the truth is, it wasn't James at all. It was that our hearts had become divided. In this season of our lives, we didn't have the margin for such a large commitment. But I was so fixated on James's adorable droopy eyes, horse-like stature, and my desire to fill the void of our first Mastiff, that I didn't pause long enough in the planning to even ask the hearts in our own home. Was this really something they wanted? Were they really okay with this choice? Was there another pet that they would have been more excited to welcome into our family? Was this a case of a good thing at the wrong time? Did we have margin in our calendar or finances or the physical space in our home to get a dog of this size? Processing those questions in retrospect further illuminated my selfish heart. I was so focused on getting what I wanted that I didn't even stop to consider what the rest of the family wanted. It was a picture-perfect case of surface unity, not soul unity. The whole family had agreed it was okay and said yes to my request. But deep down, this was not what they wanted at all. And my 8 and 10-year-olds were showing more sacrificial love than I was. Talk about a wake-up call. My heart became heavy with what my own selfishness had put my family through over the last 6 months. And I knew it was my turn to change what needed changing. I searched around and found a sweet retired couple who had been on the hunt for a fully trained young Mastiff. A few weeks later, Isaac and I drove James out to their family farm in Oregon's wine country and placed his bed near the wood stove in their kitchen. It felt like a perfect match and a sweet ending to an uncomfortable story. Even though it was difficult walking away from a pet I'd grown to really care for, seeing peace, calmness, and laughter be restored to our home made it more than worth it. It's amazing how much tension and stress had been brought into our home because of that decision without me even realizing it. And once James was gone and everyone seemed to sigh a collective deep breath, it was even more obvious how affected we all were by him. Looking back, I am so thankful I didn't continue trying to make something work that the people I love most didn't want to work in the first place. James has become a lesson to me to explore things further and dig deeper as we make decisions as a family. I can't always take agreement as unity, and maybe you shouldn't either, especially if you live with amazing selfless people like I do, or are surrounded by people-pleasing types. Simply agreeing might not be the full story, and it's up to us to explore the hearts that share our home. We all need to press into the Holy Spirit to help us differentiate between the two, and to help us land at a place that is truly the best way forward. The more I walk with Jesus, the more I see Him in the little everyday moments, and I'm learning to pay more attention. As I've emptied my calendar and made more room for Him and what matters in my life, I've become more tuned to notice things as they unfold. James's story has shown me that peace is worth fighting for, and that when you can't seem to find it, maybe there's something that needs to be explored, or quite possibly, even uprooted. It's taught me to listen and to wait, and to explore the eye rolls and frustrated tones, even if it means I may hear something I don't want to. The people around me are always saying something, even if they aren't talking. And it's my job, as someone the Lord has placed to steward them, to pay close attention. Chapter 23. Trees. Live in such a way that men may recognize that you've been with Jesus. Charles Spurgeon. This morning I woke up to a blanket of white and a sacred silence. The kind of silence that comes after a fresh snowfall that forces the world to be still, to wait. I made my way through the dark, creating creaking footsteps down the hall. The beams of light from our post outside snuck their way through the cracks in the curtains and onto the floor beneath my toes. I walked, as I always do, straight for the Keurig in the coffee corner beneath Isaac's grandmother's milk glass collection. The sky was navy outside, not black or bright blue, but a hazy navy, as it often is this time of morning when the sun has made its way to our neck of the woods but hasn't yet peeked over the mountaintops. As I poured my creamer and began to stir my coffee, I looked out the window and saw the most beautiful sight along the fence at the edge of our property. 12 trees, covered in layers of snow, glistening in the sunrise. The mere sight of them made me gasp and take a second look in disbelief. It was beyond stunning. Something more out of a majestic movie that set than my backyard. You may be tilting your head to the side and saying, "Karen, it's just trees and snow. It's not exactly mind-blowing." And to that, I tell you this. You're right. It's not mind-blowing. Usually. Snow-covered trees have been the backdrop of my entire upbringing. When you grow up in the Pacific Northwest, you get spoiled by things like towering evergreens dancing under heaven's sugar. So I completely get why this morning's picture would not be shocking. Yet it was. I couldn't stop staring at this row of trees at the base of our pasture. I feel it necessary to tell you that the reason I was so enamored with them was because just hours before, as we settled into our evening and I grabbed my bottle of cider looking out the same window, those 12 trees were the bane of my aesthetically obsessed existence. Every day, for the past, say, 380 days, those trees have tormented me with their sheer ugliness. Now, I love trees with the best of them, but these trees had a personal vendetta to try and eat away at my joy. Why? Because these trees are dead. All 12 of them. And I mean, dead, dead. Every day they taunt me with their brittle, bare brown branches and see-through bodies. Last year I saved up a lot of money and bought a dozen 11-foot cedar trees to line the fence between us and our neighbor's house down the hill. Our views are my favorite part of this property, and yet the only thing I wanted to change was seeing the side of our neighbor's house, complete with red metal trailers, campers, about 7 cars parked at all times, and oodles of garbage cans. I hope you can hear my dissatisfaction with the situation. So, shortly after we moved in, I made it my mission to fix the eyesore in the most efficient and beautiful way. We could have built a fence, but somehow that felt weird being surrounded by farmland. So I set my heart on trees. I called around and found a nursery that carried tall and mature cedars. I made friends with the old man who ran the place, and he suggested red cedars would grow the fastest and provide the most blockage from the neighbors. He referred me to a lawn and garden company who would deliver the trees and plant them. It was the most perfect plan, until it wasn't. Shortly after the trees were planted, we got hit with torrential rain and insanely high winds. The trees couldn't handle the impact, and many of them fell over. We put them back in place, staked them, and figured all would be well. Over the next few months, we watched them lose color and strength and fullness, until one day we looked up and were greeted with bare limbs and sparse bunches of orange needles. I've been meaning to go pull them out for months now, but I couldn't bear to admit the defeat. I'd failed. I couldn't even get trees to grow in the Christmas tree capital of the world. And removing these dead trees from our fence line was like coming to terms with so many of my failures and heartaches. So I just left them there, dead, barren. A vast display of ugliness and disappointment greeting me in my coffee every morning and causing my soul to grieve with frustration. Every morning started this way, for nearly 400 mornings, until this one. This morning I looked down upon my tree-lined fence and was met with the magic of heaven. Old made new, dirty made clean, ugly putting on the clothes of breathtaking beauty. I just stood there, awestruck. I stared harder and harder as I tried to make sense of it, looking with deep intensity, trying to see a glimpse of the dead brown limbs under the white, sparkly blanket. But I couldn't. All I could see was snow. All I could see was this bright, white, shining wall of beauty, glistening with freshness and wonder and a peaceful presence that was almost magical. Okay, let's face it. It was completely magical. My 12 dead trees weren't even recognizable under the glory, and I instantly saw pieces of my own heart wrapped up in their branches. Why do I fight so hard to do everything on my own with a Savior who wants to wash me like snow and cover me in himself? Why do I insist on believing that I am forgotten, looked over, and left behind when I am clearly engulfed by the love of the King? I bet if those trees could brush away enough snow from their imaginary tree eyes to look in the mirror, they wouldn't even believe what they saw. The beauty on their own bodies. The majesty before them, completely covering them. Even with the cold of the snow up against their bark, and the glory visibly on their frames, they might still feel the sting of ugliness and rejection of not being able to succeed at what they were created to do. We all do this, me especially. As I reflect on the last 20 years of my pursuit of God, I can come up with countless times, sadly, when I did this very thing, when I forgot whose I was, and continued to walk down a path clothed in barren not-enoughness instead of dressing in the fullness that comes with being clothed in Christ. It feels almost impossible for me to see myself as anything but the small-town high school girl who barely graduated. Somewhere along the line, I started putting on clothes I was never meant to wear. They came in the form of failures, shades of shame, and believing other people's whispers over God's. And before long, that's how I identified myself. Even worse, I was convinced that's how everyone else identified me too. I don't know where you are today, friend, or where your heart is, for that matter. I don't know if you're flying high or fighting back the tears from yet another broken heart or shattered dream. But I do know that somewhere along the line, we've all believed something about ourselves that we were never meant to believe. Maybe it's that you will never succeed at what you love like that gal who seems to do it so effortlessly. Maybe it's that you believe you are too old, too young, too single, or too weighed down with mommy duties to pursue anything. Maybe it's more serious than all of that because someone has wounded your insides and shattered your heart. And you're left trying to sort through the pieces of too many failures, too many upsets, too many tears. And as you've been trying to learn how to stand up on your own 2 feet again, you've picked up these lies and used them to help you stand, never realizing that as long as you still have your hands on them, you'll never stand fully upright. You've got to let go and stand tall. Forgive that betrayer and yourself for owning any piece of that tragedy. Dear one, it's not your fault, so please stop carrying it. And if in case it is your fault, give yourself the grace our Savior died for you to have. He didn't die so that we could continue living in our bondage, holding on to our heartache, and swallowing lies about ourselves that keep holding us back and shoving us down. He died so that we could be free. And freedom doesn't wear chains of what was. Freedom lifts off, flies high, and embraces all that he is. Matthew Henry's commentary says this: being baptized into Christ, we are baptized into his death. That as he died and rose again, so we should die unto sin and walk in newness and holiness of life. The putting on of Christ according to the gospel consists not in outward imitation, but in a new birth, an entire change. An entire change. An entire change. This entirety forces me to look deep into the eyes of what my heart used to believe. It causes me to grapple with it, wrestle it, make sense of it. It's not a change that encompasses action alone, but the entire being. The soul, the heart, the eyes, the thoughts, the words, the beliefs, entire, all of it, without any left out. Putting on the clothes of Christ is a full surrender not just to walk in the ways of righteousness, but to think through and believe them as well. It's an act of totally surrendering our own look in favor of looking like him. Much like the trees that were unrecognizable under the covering of the snow, I want to be unrecognizable under the clothes of Christ. I want to act and think and believe in ways that are honoring to the Savior who lives inside me and covers me whole. Where the sins of my past and the yuck of my heart are washed white in snow and shine brightly of the transformation he can do in a life. I want people to stop in their tracks when they see him on me. The glistening, blinding sight of dead limbs blanketed in the whitest, freshly fallen snow, just as I did that morning. I want unrecognizable newness laced in earth-shattering grace, covered whole in him, to walk freely in love and life and confidence and service as he intended I would. And I want that for you too. Chapter 24. Fully here. No one will ever get to the end of their lives and wish they had spent less time with their children. Anonymous. Isaac and I make a point to have a blast with our kids. And better yet, we have a blast embarrassing our kids. Not in a rude, hurtful, call them out kind of way, but in a let's chaperone their prom in 80s clothes or make out in the kitchen as they cover their eyes kind of way. It's funny that we are like this too, because none of our parents were the embarrass us types. Well, come to think of it, my dad definitely was. So maybe mine came from him. But even still, this laughter-making, laid-back, comfortable love has found its way into our family rhythms and become one of the heartbeats of our home, and I simply adore it. It hasn't always been this way, though. For years, more than I care to admit, the atmosphere of our home was more like walking on eggshells than joining our kids in dance parties and watching them ride laps around our kitchen island on balance bikes. Isaac is a perfectionist, and I'm a peacemaker. He avoids pain with anger, and I flee uncomfortable conversations in my attempt to avoid all conflict. It's an amazingly brilliant combination. I hope you can sense my sarcasm. Truth is, it was more like the perfect storm than wedded bliss, and it led to way too many years of fighting, hurting hearts, and shutting down. Until one day, some odd years ago, we just stopped talking about things. The stress and sadness that accompanied these conversations was too much to handle anymore, so we opted out. Denial and avoidance seemed like the only method of survival, and our phones, computers, and laptops became our drug of choice. Jumping online and scrolling through the lives of other people took us into a world that allowed us to forget about all of the things weighing down our hearts and minds at home, even if just for a moment. I would get lost in pretty farmhouses adorned with wraparound porches and white furniture with striped pillows, and Isaac zoned out on manly things like tactical guns, camping gear, overland vehicles, and football games. In those days, our lives were a melting pot of sadness and practicing survival skills from the countless losses, unproductiveness from the overwhelm, and frustration with unmet expectations. Our marriage was rocky because our individual souls were a hot mess, and our work left us drained, unfulfilled, and overwhelmingly exhausted. It's no wonder we longed for the self of our screens. Somehow, the ache of our own lives hummed a little quieter when we could distract it with the lives of others. And all the while, an addiction was forming and growing stronger with every scroll of our thumbs and double tap of our pointer fingers. To make matters worse, we were raising tweens. Tweens who were watching us with great intensity and making up laws in their hearts about how the world worked and what their place was in it. I started imagining our house 5 years down the road when we had full-on teenagers lounging on our sofas. I imagined the heartache I would feel if I walked into a room filled with gangly bodies and blank stares. In my imagination, I would try to engage and ask a question or bring up a fun conversation, but they wouldn't even look up. I pictured them tall and possibly awkward, battling their own internal wars, yet sitting at the table entranced by their screens, disconnected from the very people who could answer questions to help them make sense of their worlds again. In a brief yet vivid moment of horror, I saw myself. So self-involved, distracted, and completely unaware of the actual life that was unfolding and connecting all around me. How dare I? How dare I give them this as a picture of the world? I couldn't even process what was being uncovered in my own heart, and yet, at the same time, things had never been clearer. This disconnected society we live in was coming after my home with a fierce and alluring vengeance. It was after my family, after my children, after me. And I didn't even see it coming. In Jenny Allen's Bible study, Proven, a specific phrase in the introduction pierced me straight through the gut. So if I were your enemy, I would make you numb and distract you from God's story. Technology, social media, Netflix, travel, food, wine, and comfort. I would not tempt you with notably bad things or you would get suspicious. I would distract you with everyday comforts that slowly feed you a different story and make you forget God. Then you would dismiss the Spirit leading you, loving you, and comforting you, Then you would start to love comfort more than surrender and obedience and souls. Ouch. Am I the only one who got slapped across the face with conviction while listening to these words? Yikes. Not only was this addiction of mine keeping me from actually enjoying my family and being present, but ultimately it was distracting me from the only thing that truly matters, God himself and his plans for me. I spent the next several days, okay months, trying to shift the blame. I made all of the excuses in the book that declared I didn't have to be the first one to change. I mean, let's be real. I own several businesses that require work online, a presence on social media, and answering emails. My phone is a very convenient way to cross off a ton of duties while not letting work invade my whole life. But wait, is it really not invading my whole life? A less phone time concept was beginning to convict my heart. It felt all too familiar and simultaneously so uncharted. I had to remind myself that only a decade ago, I didn't even know what a text message was. And now the majority of my communication was locked up in this tiny 3x5 box I carried in my pocket. Am I the only one that feels deep sadness about that? Do you? I felt adult tantrums creeping up and trying to take over my mind. And let's be real, my face too. Isaac always teases me that I'm the worst liar on the planet. I guess there are worse things to be bad at, but in the event that you actually want your face to lie for you, this "my face can't lie" gene is really infuriating. I wanted to have it all together. I wanted to be the one without the problem. I wanted to be able to sit my family down, have a Brady Bunch-style family meeting, and declare to them that we had a new rule about gadgets and there were about to be some big changes around our home. The problem, though, was that this epiphany of mine had nothing to do with tightening the reins on these tiny humans I was raising, and everything to do with tightening my reins. As much as I don't want to admit it, what my kids are learning about how the world works and what they take on as their own habits starts with me. I can't sit them down and lecture them on excessive iPad habits if I myself am so engrossed in scrolling or work or responding to one last email that I don't even realize they are speaking to me. I can't give them 20-minute time limits if I don't honor the same rules. And worse, work on the computer all night while completely ignoring the hearts in my own home. "Just a minute, honey," was a phrase I spoke way too often. And let's be real, it was never just one more minute. That minute usually lasted for hours. Sometimes days, and I needed to make it stop. It feels so surfacey and unmeaningful to talk about gadgets and gizmos aplenty, yet here I sit, typing away on the very thing that has the power to take over my entire life, and my heart too if I'm not careful. As insignificant as it can seem to bear my techie addictions and admit to being a productivity-driven workaholic, I feel not mentioning these things would be far more damaging. This behavior of mine held the power to significantly change the course of my home and my history. So I feel I owe it to you, and to myself, to at least broach the subject. It's a problem that my 3-year-old brings me my phone from the kitchen because he's trained to always see me with it. It's a problem when Isaac has to get my attention because one of the kids is trying to tell me something and I don't even notice they are talking. It's a problem that we as a society tend to text a family member from the other room of the same house, instead of just getting up, walking over to them, and engaging in a real conversation. It's a problem going on a date or a trip or being in a conversation, and I just can't stop touching my phone. Often Isaac asks me what I'm doing or what I'm looking at, and I don't even have an answer. Truth is, I don't even know what I was looking at. I just started pressing buttons and swiping and scrolling without having the slightest idea why. Or equally as bad, I may be checking my phone for a valid reason, but I haven't mastered the self-control to wait 5 minutes till the kids are in bed to do so. What in the actual world is wrong with me? I wish I was an isolated case, the only one with this issue, but I have a sense that very few of us are immune to this techie epidemic. To be quite honest, it hurts my heart when I go to someone's house for dinner and they play games on their tablet or phone instead of engaging with me. Or worse, when they think they are engaging with me, but it's more like nodding and murmuring, Yeah, okay. And they don't take their eyes off the screen. This was a huge wake-up call to help me beat my own habits of doing the same thing with the kids. It hurts when I walk into a room full of people who are together, but not really. It hurts when I see couples at dinner laughing about something they are reading on their phones instead of causing their loved one right in front of them to laugh. This isn't normal, friend, and it's not healthy. Somehow our society has morphed into a world where disconnect and Truman Show-type broadcasting of our lives has trumped actually being present in our real ones. What hurts the most is knowing that I have been more of a participant than a spectator in almost every area I listed above. I hate to think that I may have caused, or may still cause, any member of my family or the people I share my actual life with to feel less than or not worthy of my time because I couldn't wait until I was alone to check my phone. And for what? So I can see what game someone else is playing with their kids instead of playing one with mine? It's crazy, right? All of this gadgety talk is starting to make me feel a little crazy. I wish with every part of my being that this wasn't an issue. I wish that we as a society hadn't gone here in the first place, that I hadn't. But we have. And I love my family, and you, dear listener, too much to ignore it any longer. I am a serious, phone-loving, email-checking, text-sending, workaholic mama who gets way too pumped up on productivity, and I really have a problem. Well, had a problem. They say that the first step is admission, right? And it definitely was for me. Still is on occasion if I don't keep myself in check. But being honest about it was the first and hardest step. Once I identified the problem, it somehow lost a bit of its power. I was aware, so I was accountable. It weakened after it came to the surface, which was mind-blowing for me. And seemingly, in an instant, it went from a problem to a process. And for me, a huge part of it was allowing my loved ones into my mess and giving them the freedom to call me out and keep me accountable when they saw me breaking one of my own rules. Now I have more of an ongoing journey than a huge problem. I get to choose daily which path I will take, what I will pick up, and what I will put down. It all started with a choice. And now I get to keep choosing every day, sometimes by the minute, what is going to win my time, my family or my phone. But I had to engage the battle as a battle. I couldn't keep ignoring the issue or wait for others in my house to change first. It would have been easy for me to feel I had to change only when my kids changed or when my husband changed. But that's not very adult now, is it? I had to be the one to embrace a new rhythm and chart a new path, no matter what anyone else in my house chose to do. I had to set new boundaries and make the tough calls for myself and pray they'd follow. Someone always has to be the first to apologize, the first to jump, the first to dare to live differently. And as much as I wish I didn't have to be, why shouldn't it be me? Why should I wait for someone else to take control of their life and live with no regrets before I do? I don't really know how we as a culture got this far off the path so quickly, but it's actually a bit frightening. When our oldest was in kindergarten, I still had a flip phone. I didn't even know how to send a text message or even what it was. But in the past 8 years, we've gotten uncomfortably off course. And it's my responsibility to make sure that for me and my home, we find our way back to a healthy balance. The digital world is a fascinating place and a huge blessing if we use it right. But just like my favorite chocolate peanut butter swirl brownies, too much, left unchecked, is going to make you sick. And it's just not worth it. I want to live a life of being fully available and fully present for the ones I love. And for too long, I've lived a life so maxed out with my own little world, responsibilities, and career aspirations that I haven't had room in my mind or margin in my heart for the loves of my life that I share my actual days with. My striving for professional success left no room for my husband, my kids, my extended family, and my friends. And that's simply not the legacy I wanted to leave. Jesus modeled love with his availability, and I'd hate to think that I could miss out on the life he has for me, or worse, teach my kids to tune out what he has for them because I'm too distracted, overscheduled, or simply too invested in the online world to be fully alive in my real one. I want to live a life where the people I love and those I'm around know they matter. And even more than that, I want them to know that they are seen and that they are worth it. Worth my time, worth my eye contact, worth being heard. I want to sit down for coffee or lunch or dinner and have them all know that I'm with them, fully, no distractions. With so much of the world vying for my attention, it's an ongoing battle, sweet friend, a fierce one. This digital age and the world of social media are alluring, but I can't think of a battle more worthy of engaging in than the one that's trying to distract me from the time with God, with my kids, and living my own life. As a business owner, it wasn't realistic for me to say that I was going to just stop being on my phone. But it was realistic for me to say that I'm going to set up boundaries so that my kids rarely see me on my phone. I'm not saying I do this 100% of the time, because that wouldn't be realistic either. But keeping this ideal at the forefront of my mind has really helped me conquer the struggle. Instead of carrying my phone around me all the time now, I keep it in another room while I'm at home. If I need to post something to my business social media accounts or check my email, I go to the garage for a few minutes and take care of those tasks between switching laundry. Then, when the task is complete, I bring the phone back in the house, usually on top of a basket of peppermint-scented laundry, and put it back in my room. Out of sight, out of mind.